Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program Jane McElevey, labor organizer, columnist at The Nation, author of multiple books, most recent Rules to Win by Power and Participation in Union Negotiations, and also the subject of a really great profile in the and well-deserved in the New Yorker magazine, How Jane McElevey Transformed the Labor Movement. Jane, welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure to be on the show because you are such smart and engaging hosts, really.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. And I have to say, like, you know, I think we first interviewed you on this program back in 2016. And I think it was for No Shortcuts, the book you wrote on organizing. And I have to say, like, you have been a bellwether for me personally in terms of, like, assessing these things. And we've had over the years many people call in, particularly in the past couple of years in the wake of COVID, call in saying, I want to unionize my shop. I'm working here. You are one of the resources that we point people to sort of like think about how to do this. And really, I mean, over those 6 or 7 years, there has been a transformation. It feels like, within the labor movement and just the sentiment, which, you know, may have started, I think, for me, like, if I was to say, you know, around the Chicago teachers strike, where we saw that first real sort of like sense of social justice unionism. Give us a little bit of an overview before we get into like what happened with the UAW, of like why you think that's happened.
You know, I think several things. One is there really has been a significant change in just the last decade. And I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, my first book was called Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. And that came out in 2012, kind of coinciding with Chicago. And that book, from the title of it, because we'll get to that with UAW, but we'll stick to Chicago for a minute and some stuff in between. You know, the first thing I learned as a young trade union organizer with the working class as beaten down as it was when I was aging, you know, into being a full-time organizer in the mid-1990s was my mentors all said, first and most important thing you can do, McElevey, is raise workers' expectations that they can win again, that they deserve a better life, and that they can actually, if they team up together and build a really solid workplace structure and hold the community with them, they actually can still strike and they can still win. A combination of less parts for real, as I think you know, why they're not all my best friends, but the national trade union leadership in many cases was absolutely complicit in what I called lowering workers' expectations. Strikes are so hard and let's just work with the Democratic Party and we can work this all out. And that obviously was pretty seriously flawed. So I was writing about, in that very first book, everyone says it reads more like a novel. Like people would write to me and say, I fell asleep at I'm way past my subway stop. I couldn't put that one chapter down. Because that's just me telling stories of 10 years of nonstop victories with workers all over the United States. So it's like, obviously some people have methods that are still working. Everyone I work with, all of my comrades in the movement. So that book was like stories, fun, motivating, and it was all deeply real. And then, actually, I got ill then with a different diagnosis that took me out of the work for a while. And Francis Fox Piven, the famous sociologist, author of Poor People's Movement, said to me, oh my God, this book, we need a different version. We need like one that has 300 citations, Jane, and that isn't about your fight, but go find me ones like yours and do a dissertation. All right, I didn't have to pay for it, great. So did that and went right to Chicago to start figuring out what's going on in Chicago because I'd been hearing about it already from when they won in 2010, the internal union election where they threw out an old guard, complicit. I don't even think they like workers very much, let alone students, parents, and the community, that kind of local union leadership. And in came this magnificent Karen Lewis, teacher of the year, African-American woman, and just slammed out and won the public over from then Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, who was set to decimate, finally just privatize, close. You know, he closed 44 schools at once And Karen just said, we're beating this guy. It's like the end of public education, or we're going to beat him. So that strike has massive significance. I got to put that at the center almost with another big case in Smithfield in the South. Those two, I think, were the cornerstone of the case studies and their shortcuts in my dissertation to really show methodically, not on my own campaigns, how do you do the work? And that did raise expectations for almost every good local union in the United States of America that we can actually do this. So fast forward, that moves into West Virginia kicking off in 2018. There's people who study grouped. There's a lot of study grouping of No Shortcuts all around the country. Unbeknownst to me, there were people in local unions who didn't have supportive national leadership ordering that book, creating discussion guides. It was crazy. So 2018 kicks off with an illegal statewide West Virginia teacher strike. And then that just goes Arizona, Kentucky, Ohio. Like Arizona was an illegal 75,000 worker teacher walkout. And I don't think that any of this would have ended but for the pandemic, or get sort of a lid put on it. The pandemic put a lid on what was already a, we're sick of this. We're sick and tired of saying we can rely on the Democratic Party, apropos the conversation you were just having before I came on. Like, what are we relying on them for? So, you know, the only way to prove you can win is by having a massive strike that you win. And then more workers want to take the risk to go on strike because they keep seeing more victories and suddenly it's not as risky for them. Then the pandemic hits, creates a crisis for everybody, right? You're either ordered home or you're ordered against your will with no gear to go to work, grocery store workers, healthcare workers, all of them. And they start to die. So people really died in large numbers in trade union, workers in trade unions, leaders calling up about going to another funeral. Okay. And then burying their patients. If you were a nursing home worker, we know that that's where the slaughter happened in the largest numbers, black, brown people in a nursing home. They come out, doesn't take but long to go from all the rhetoric about essential, we're essential, to actually you don't mean anything, we're laying you off and cutting your pay, not giving you an inflationary raise, and whatever. And I, you know, we've hit this moment. And the one, I'll wrap by saying just initially here, I was just in Canada all weekend giving a keynote speech and some training to an up-and-coming provincial union. People here might not know there was actually the first provincial-wide strike that was illegal a year ago, almost to the day now, that shut down the province and was a real first threat of a general strike that I've seen anywhere close to here in a long time up over the border. And, you know, when I was doing a part of a Q&A, the new president, a new progressive president of that union set, who had brought me in, said, I don't think that the words leader ID, structure test, there's a whole bunch of vocabulary that you've given to the entire movement that didn't exist like 10 years ago. And it's really real. Like people come up to me and say, we have to learn how to do those structure tests better. But that's what you say is how we know whether or not we're ready to win, right? And I'm like, fundamental. You know, so there's a lot of change happening. And then we'll get to the UAW and the more recent stuff. But there's a lot of change. And I think we're in a really good trajectory right now. Maybe not fast enough for the climate clock, but we're definitely trying because that's what's new. There's a different kind of deadline. That's all.
You mentioned how the Chicago teacher strike was sort of predicated on a change in leadership in the union. And really the UAW, same situation, in part, like with an assist, I guess, from the DOJ.
I was just going to say that. That's exactly right. A big assist.
All right. Well, walk us through that so that everybody understands that.
Yeah, I mean, a huge assist. And that's not bad. As organizers, you've got to be ready to capture a moment when it's presented to you. So a bunch of members in the UAW did. But I'll just say without that assist, without the corruption scandal. So there was a long investigation, similar to the one that went on in the Teamsters in the 90s, like a multi-year monitor was assigned, a corruption scandal. There were hints of a giant corruption scandal inside the National United Auto Workers. Monitors and trustees were sent in from the federal government to start doing an investigation. And lo and behold, what all of us knew, I mean, I'm a member of the UAW, right, in the academic division. So what all of us knew forever was the place was corrupt as any, I was going to say DeSantis, but, you know, I've got to get the analogy right. That's not quite right. But the Supreme Court, I don't know, getting closer to corruption levels that are pretty high. But anyway, and so there was the corrupt staff were peeled out of the way. You know, neutral people got put into positions. And then smart people in the progressive forces, United Workers for Democracy, a small caucus formed and thought that we're going to demand a referendum to elect, to direct elect the president of this union, which has never happened in the entire life of the United Auto Workers. It was always to like a convention, delegates, and then they pick who the leader is. Totally controlled, completely top down. Don't even try to run from those convention spots if you don't want to, you know, find your tires slashed, whatever. I mean, really bad stuff. So it's a very low turnout, like very low turnout election in the referendum, I think 2.5 years ago. My timeline is, everything is just nuts after the pandemic in my brain timeline wise. I very excitedly like waited for my ballot in the mail, voted yes to have direct election of the United Auto Workers president to remove the corrupting, corruptible, still layer of bureaucracy that's not great in the union. And we win. I mean, that's all analysis, but actually like the workers win a direct election. And I'm caught off guard by that. And again, it happened because it was a very low turnout. I mean, the administration caucus who ran the union into the ground forever called the administration caucus versus United All Workers for Democracy caucus. No, soundbite there. And then that set the stage for a team of opposition leaders to run for office for the first time at the presidency. And that becomes Sean Fain, the new president. And even that was a squeaker.
To the extent that there was still an establishment, because a lot of like, what is it, two different like presidents, obviously former presidents go to jail over this. There was a lot of corruption. They were using, you know, dues to basically just live an exorbitant lifestyle. There was some question, I think, too, of like whether they were getting money directly from the people they were supposedly negotiating with.
Yeah.
But to the extent that there was any sort of like establishment left that still had control of the system within the UAW, how is it they didn't like turn out the vote, I guess, to sort of like maintain that power structure? Did they just underestimate, you know, what was going on out there?
Yeah, definitely. They'd had control for so long. I think that they were so arrogant, they could not imagine that they would be beat. So I think it's like the same thing with, say, in a union fight. If you have an A-level boss campaign, a B-level boss campaign, a C-level boss fight, and there's tiers of it. And one of the things we say that gets a lot of workers in trouble if people skip steps in an organizing campaign is that if you do win, that's where they usually hire, like if the boss is asleep at the switch, that's what we call it, like the boss is asleep at the switch and the workers won. On the other hand, that's good, but that's why there's a lot of this, we can't get to first contracts for 480 days stuff going on because they skipped steps. I wrote a book called No Shortcuts. They skipped steps. In this case, they were asleep at the switch. They were constrained by the monitors. They couldn't just go into the database and do whatever they wanted with ballots and stuff them and all that stuff. And it was crucially a low turnout. So our side turned out in higher numbers than theirs did. And there was a real effort, like a really good effort by a bunch of people who are now in the headquarters to drive out a yes vote on direct democracy, one member, one vote for the presidency. It was a very good campaign. It's close still. But I think the internal opposition, meaning in this case, opposition to democracy, the administration caucus, I think they mostly just missed it and then it was too late. And then it got even harder in the race for the presidency because they were much more onto it, which is why it went into a recount and a recount and a recount and a recount and a recount until Fain squeaked out the victory. And what a good thing.
Before we get like, you know, take the storyline from Fain onward, I just also want to ask about the UAW's inclusion. You mentioned that you're part of the academic part of the UAW. And there's something like, I think it's like 80,000 workers in higher education are members of the UAW. And that's in terms of those numbers, a relatively recent phenomenon. It's like, how much did the inclusion of those people who tend to be, at least this is my understanding, more left wing I guess, or more, you know, in some ways, yeah, I mean, progressive, left wing, however you want to, then, you know, maybe your average, or just more engaged in the unionization process, than the average, UAW member might have been. How much did that, like the existence of those folks within the UAW end up leading to the surprise that the administrative caucus, for instance, you know, was caught off guard? And how much of like, how much is that sort of, you know, influencing also what's going on with the UAW through Sean Fain's election and into the strike?
I think it'd be silly to say that there was not any influence on that. And I think that was particularly true for the first vote, for the demand for one member, one vote, for what we call direct democracy. I think that the academic, the growing academic division, probably weighed more heavily in there, just because I think for most people, members in the UAW, from any sector, but certainly longtime core of the industry, the auto sector, just probably couldn't even believe that that was possible. So I think in that initial round, which then sets up everything else, maybe it's slightly true, but I don't think when it got to the point of being able to throw the bums out and elect new leadership, I don't think that was, I think every single worker, probably starting with the auto workers, honestly, was ready to pull the lever for someone else. And Fain comes out of the rank and file membership for decades. Right. He's super real. He's not from the academic division. Hardly any of the ones who won were. I think one for sure was. Okay, and there's a new division created for the West Coast, where just at the University of California, there's 48,000 members. So there's a whole new West Coast academic sort of division. Then they get the Harvards and whatever. It is interesting, but and it'll become problematic if in the agreement moving forward, I think, if there isn't really strong what's called bargaining to organize language in these settlements. There's too many details we don't know about yet to get too deep into it, honestly. We can say some top lines, but there's a lot of unknowns. They just posted the Ford one, and it's 360 pages and meant only for lawyers to read. It's the most, I don't believe in doing that in contracts at all. But in fairness, they did really good work in 5 months from when Sean won in March, was certified as president in March. 1 week before, or basically walking into the bargaining convention to set up the big three negotiations. I mean, the guy had just taken office like days before, after all the delays by the administration caucus to try and unseat him and catch him on something like wrong guy. It was all of you who used to get caught doing that stuff, you know. But given the time frame they had, the fact that they're stuck with 400 practically long page contracts, I like to have them down to about 20, or even one, as my mentors taught me. It says, everything is the way we want it, and we will sign off on any changes. Like, you know, I always say that's right. The ideal union contract. It's a page, not 380 pages of lawyer talk. But anyway, so yeah, I think the academic stuff matters, but I think this period is about putting the core jurisdictions of the United Auto Workers, which is the auto workers, parts suppliers, supply shops, they're all different divisions, but putting them back at the center of their own historic union, and well done on that account. So I don't think the academic vote had any difference in electing Fain. And yeah, I really don't. And the slate that came with Fain. I think everyday ordinary people in that union were sick and tired of concessions, and that was hitting the auto sector the most. Decades of concessions. I think every one of them perfectly understood what was going on and couldn't wait to have a real choice.
Jane, could you talk a bit more about the strategy that was deployed by the UAW and Sean Fain? Because, I mean, it was a wonderful blend, at least from the outside, watching in, of discipline and militancy, but also strategy of rolling out different strikes and targeting them towards, you know, if this automakers not negotiating in a good faith, or we're struggling to make headway here, we're going to target this plant, etc. I found that to be pretty I don't know, inspiring in its strategy. And I'm wondering if you think that has more salience as we're in this kind of labor renaissance here.
Oh, a labor renaissance. Woo! It's a permanent future. But anyway, strategy matters. I mean, that's the core to every single book I've written, is what is it? How do you do it? What's power? How do you do strategy? I've long argued and continue to argue and maybe get to squeeze one more book out, trying fast, on the question of power and strategy. Because you can't do good strategy if you can't do good power structure analysis. Like, people just go running in a million directions all the time, you know, and think whatever. So I was not deep in the strategy, mind you, but I think what has to be true, because I've run enough multi-shop strikes myself, is that you have to start by targeting where is the biggest profit being made. So you have to do that analysis. Three quarters of unions don't even do it. They don't even do it. They just go running, you know? So one is you got to start by really having a serious economic analysis of what plants or whatever, fill in the blank, grocery stores, whatever, what plants, what chains, whatever it is, can cost the single most amount of money to give you higher value if that's the plant you close or the stores you close or the fill in the blank. Pilots in a successful airline industry, you know, you're going to go for the which is the most successful, who's got money to spend. If you get to the table, right, the employer has to have money to spend and you have to be able to cause them a crisis. If you can't cause a crisis for the employer, you cannot win the kind of gains that I believe that they have just won. So that's one. And then because they had just literally, Spain had just been sworn in again in March with a giant convention coming up around like a week later and contract expirations coming up, right, in September at all the big three. So then it's, if we're honest, I think that I always prefer to be, then you've got an organizing team. You got financial people assessing which plants, which states. You got an organizing team assessing who can we get ready fast enough? Where are they ready? And that combination of where can we hit them hard and where are the workers ready? Because we're not ready. The union is not rebuilt overnight after 40 something years of straight corruption. You don't have workers with even a muscle memory, except some of the really long timers or the fathers or mothers, you know, yelling at the young ones, do it, go do it, go do it. There's a lot of that in the UAW because the generation before them really does remember it. But they had to see it once. I think the John Deere strike, by the way, mattered in this progression when the John Deere workers turned down the administration caucus trying to shove that agreement down their face. That also inspired people, and those workers inspired people. There wasn't a lot of organizing there. That was just really pissed off people with a lot of earlier generation people still in the plant and around, like fathers and sons all over the John Deere strike on the lines, right? And wives and sisters in a very kind of traditional way supporting all those workers. So I think that is real strategy. And I don't know the absolute final ways in which they did it, but it's definitely a combination of a power analysis, which is a labor market economic analysis, cost them the most. We were doing that in Vegas. We were doing that nationally in SEIU back when there was a national brain power like that, where we were, you know, I was deputy director in 2003, and I had a project to figure out what 60 labor markets could we go to. If we wanted to organize the whole hospital industry, like where we had the power to grow out. And then my boss said, okay, we can't fund the head of the healthcare division at SEIU. Good people back then said, okay, we can't fund 60 organizing campaigns at that scale. Give me 25. And then we got I was directing a research team that got it down to 25 labor markets. If we take big for profits in these labor markets, we're going to take the country union effectively. And then where can we get the workers ready in time? Because doing a really hard strike, despite the myth, just like organizing JFK, Amazon, despite the myth, which I said before that one too, it isn't self-evident how to actually organize people, but everyone can do it. Everyone can do it. But there's a lot of things that are not immediately self-evident, like a bunch of people sign up right away and you get to that 30% and you file for election with exactly the legal requirement of 30%. You built no structure inside the facility. You file for an election and you good luck getting that first contract. You know what I mean? So So there was real strategy. I hope it all comes out in much more detail, and I'm sure it will at some appropriate moment, but it's not usually till you've achieved everything you need in it before you start talking about it, like me with my first book. We had won all this stuff. And so laying out the power analysis and the strategy that we did everywhere I went, it was fine to put it out after those 10 years were up, my first 10 years.
I want to walk through a little bit more slowly on that sort of no shortcut concept, because the point of getting just what you need to move the process forward is not enough, because as soon as you do that, you're going to be met with a much stronger counterforce that is going to overcome that. I mean, the system's almost designed at that point. If you have the bare minimum to qualify for a vote, you are right in the sort of the crosshairs of what the management has the ability to overcome at that point. So you've got to go in. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's the same concept. You got to go in with sort of like as much force as you possibly can, far beyond what you need to get through the initial processes.
Yeah. In most cases, I mean, with an A-level union buster who's on the scene from day one, many workers don't get even through the first step. But the error, going back to Emma, your question, the error that I've watched so much of, too much of, is people thinking they're going to win the election, and then it's going to get easier for the workers. And to Sam's point, it's actually often going to get way, way harder, because if there was a union buster on the scene and the workers slipped through and got to that next step, there's going to be an even better union buster hired to stop the first contract fight. And I've written tons about that, right? But it's really true. And I've had that unfortunate experience in almost every NLRB, National Labor Relations Board election I've ever had the pleasure of running, and every first contract that I got, you know, when I wasn't leading a union directly anymore and I wasn't national deputy director at SEIU, after the phase where Stern went sort of in the wrong direction, the president at the time, I'm often called in now. I mean, I work first contract campaigns all the time, right? I'm always actively in the field and always teaching and always writing. So I think if you lose touch with the field and workers directly and how hard it is, and the tools as they adjust a little bit, like Jennifer Abruzzo, the Biden's head of the labor board right now, probably the single best thing we've gotten from Biden, honestly. But even that's not magic. I mean, just because you've created better laws, there's no enforcing capacity, there's no staff in the federal government. So yeah, getting a big strategic error that's dominant even now with all the excitement is how do you go from filing minimum thresholds for those elections to beating the clock on the 480 days typically before you get a first contract? And is it a good first contract? And have you taught the workers how to govern in the process of the first contract negotiations? Because if they don't know how to govern, they weren't involved in the process of negotiate their first contract negotiations, they don't really understand what the words mean, they don't remind you to keep it simple language, you don't have to write like a damn lawyer, you can write like a human being and keep the language simple in agreement. It helps when there's hundreds of them in the room with you negotiating, which is my approach. There's hundreds in the room every time I go to the table. And it can really be a war. And I'll just give one example. In Einstein, the campaign I wrote about in the new book, which is in Philadelphia. Sorry, it's a big nonprofit hospital in Philadelphia. Biggest emergency department, downtown, special, you know, services all poor people, Medicaid, Medicare, all of it. So it's just a huge hospital in the fifth largest city in the country. And they did everything that was done to Amazon. Like when I was first meeting with some of the Amazon folks way back right after the victory at JFK, they informally called for some help. That was like May, a month after the win. And they were like, yeah, but this is so different, because they filed charges against the labor board too to get us thrown out of this region where we all live. And we had to go to Arizona. And I was like, right. That's not a new strategy on the part of the boss at all. You're just so young, you know, like they don't know.
Right.
Which is why getting people involved who actually know and can coach you and teach you so that you know enough to then go do it on your own is pretty crucial. at Einstein, they did everything. Same thing. The boss sued the labor board in Philadelphia. They sued the union for stealing votes in the election. I mean, they sued us for everything, multiple targets in the lawsuits. And we won that first contract 8 months later. Eight. Not 480 days. And that's pretty
much.
Be
clear. I mean, eight months is very quick.
Record.
That time
record.
Between becoming, being unionized and getting that contract. And to that point, I mean, you bring up Abruzzo, and I do want to get to just sort of like a little bit more of an assessment of what the UAW, to the extent that we know. But since you brought up Abruzzo, that element that the National Labor Relations Board recently said that we will now consider the potential of from that period of unionization to first contract, if you're not negotiating in good faith, management, we will now consider that an unfair labor practice, in which case, and they're talking about this, I guess, at this point, of if we assess that that is an unfair labor practice in that you're scheduling meetings and not showing up or what, you're not being serious about it or whatever, that will then go to arbitration. That's sort of because the National Labor Relations Board has made a couple of moves that, you know, close to card check, sort of like a card check light at this point. But yeah, that to me seems to be the golden chalice, if you will, where once they have helped the unionization, but it seems like the anti-union industry that the has sort of like realized, okay, we're moving to our next redoubt, which is we're just going to inhibit the actual having of a contract. And in many instances, because of the nature of the turnover in our business or whatnot, we can avoid actually, you know, we can break the union down the road, even after it's elected. And that to me seems to be sort of like the golden chalice, right? If you get to the National Labor Relations Board saying, we're going to mediate a contract, we're going to send you to mediation or whatever it is.
Yes. A couple things though. One, it was always the ULP. It was always called an unfair labor practice charge. If either party could be accused successfully of stalling, not bargaining in good faith. That's always been a ULP my whole lifetime as an organizer and negotiator. The difference is there's a threat now to force them into an arbitration-like situation. Okay. But then there's a lot of other good things that Abruzzo's done, honestly, and I've written several things about it recently. But to focus in on this one for a minute, for those of us trained in the methods that I was trained in and have been teaching my whole life, which were methods from the 30s, dragged straight into the new century, one of several things. There were so many axioms I was given as a young organizer. And when I began negotiating, my mentors, who were incredible negotiating mentors, said, McAleady, always just that. There's no Jane in the labor movement. McAleady with the finger pointed at you. Don't ever let them put you into mediation. Don't ever let them put you into arbitration. Workers need to win their contract across the table, face to face, and extract the max from the boss. The boss can't go off and hide behind some arbitration or mediation process that immediately cuts out the workers. So I was trained that way, and I think many people were. And if you're doing your work correctly in terms of really organizing, recruiting the real leaders, not charismatic people, all the methods that we believe and teach and that lead consistently to success, honestly, through all the dark, that word dark, through all the bad times of my, like the labor movement got bad when I was coming of age, you know what I mean? So coming up at the worst of the labor movement, and getting to this point is such a pleasure. But if I look back, I don't think in any first contract fight, the workers ever went past 1 year, ever, ever. Like you say to the workers, you just took the way you were framing it, you just took the first step and it's gonna get hella harder right now. So there's no time to take a nap. Here's what has to happen tomorrow. If you wanna, you can just say win a contract. If you and your coworkers wanna win the fundamental changes and make the improvements that you just fought to have the right to do, it's time to step it up here, people, because they're going to come at it hard. And you be honest and you give them the statistics. You've even done that before the election. And so that they're ready for the fact that there's much more work coming. And the reason with the first book, Raising Expectations, which was all the stories, there's no contract that went past 1 year in my first 10 years in the whole labor movement. It's just like, I got taught well, I followed discipline and methods well, we win. It was shocking to me that we did it in 8 months in Philadelphia, because we didn't even get them to drop the legal charges for 5 months. So we didn't even get to negotiations till, I believe, August 17th off the top of my head in 2016.
Are there National Labor Relations Board rulings or laws or rules essentially that can provide more leverage? I mean, because that is one of the sort of, you know, it seems to me has been, you know, one of the most difficult parts is like, you can say that there's unfair labor practices, and we're going to fine you X number of dollars, but that's just the cost of doing business. That's just, is there a mechanism in which the National Labor Relations Board can provide some more leverage for workers?
They can, because in my life, it has always helped to have a labor board ruling. Like in Philadelphia, the boss was going to appeal it for 10 years to death, which is why I got called in to take the first contract fight. And, you know, getting the first ruling, that's a strong ruling by a labor board investigator saying the boss cheated, not the workers. That's an official document. If you know what to do with that, if you're ready to use that as an organizing tool, then that's always been true. So it's not necessarily what the board can do. It's what you can do. Like you can start, you know, you have a ton of smart worker leaders take that document. We put out a press release in the old days or whatever we do now, and have workers holding a press conference. And if you do your work right, you've already got a bunch of community leaders who are the kind of community leaders who threaten mayors and possible CEOs effectively just by being on screen with you. Not weak ones who are nice and liberal and do-gooders, but like powerful members of the community standing with the worker saying, we're disgusted to read this report. Apparently Einstein violated the rights of our longtime healthcare. You know, so you start building off the first decision. They appealed again. We won again. It was like they kept appealing. We kept winning. But I said to the workers, that's what the lawyers are doing. You're doing power building every damn day so that you're ready the minute they say we can get to the table, because we're going to get there. You keep fighting hard. So we're off doing majority petitions, meeting with the community, doing all these things while the lawyers are doing that official appeal. But each one is useful to us and each victory along the way. The problem with Abruzzo right now, not the problem with Abruzzo, the problem with her brilliance, she's really brilliant. She's done, if you look at all the different agency heads from Obama's era and now back into the current one with Biden, a lot of them weren't nearly as committed as her to the working class and restoring the right of the working class in a deep, deep way. She's committed and she's clever because she is working the system as hard as someone like her could do. It's pretty remarkable. But for all the good, there's no enforcement that's meaningful because there's no staff to investigate. I have friends who are regional board lawyers, you know, under agents out in the field. And their caseload it's not even possible to describe it. Like they can't get to an investigation for 2 years, right? So that's like, okay, great language from Abruzzo, great policies, good priorities. And there's some other ones we should talk about, but that's not really going to move the dial. It can help you in the campaign, but it's all going to come down to organizing end.
And just in terms of
no enforcement, no penalties. Like you said, the cost of doing business, obviously Amazon, Starbucks, fill in the blank. They don't give a crap about it. It's like 25, like you and I, the three of us.
Yeah, exactly. It's got change I would find in the couch. But there is no, there's almost no dollar figure that would really make, you know, that's what I guess what I'm asking is if it's not a forced contract, right? If it's not mediation, like in other words, or even arbitration, or just like, we're going to have a panel, we're just going to look at it and we're going to write the contract and that's it. Yeah. If that's not the answer, then what I'm hearing you say is that, like, you know, having more enforcement would at least get you the document. And the value of that document, if I understand you correctly, is to build commitment and solidarity amongst the workers to give them the sense that their fight is righteous and they have a better chance of winning it. Because at the end of the day, it is withholding labor that is ultimately, and the threat and the how much management believes that that labor is going to be withheld is where the calculation comes from. Because at one point they're going to say, like, we can go through this, but if they're going to stay on those lines for 16 months, we're just going to lose a lot of money and we're eventually going to have them back. So they'll just make that assessment. So you just need to be able to project that. And a ruling from the National Labor Relations Board, even if it's not causing the management pain, it is building power amongst workers by making them believe that we are empowered to withhold our labor.
That's right. Feeling legitimate really matters to a working class that's told they're stupid every day by every manager. It's like, honestly, what they do. So when the rulings come, like when the first one hit, so the election had been April 8th. They appealed it within the 7-day period, suing the labor board, moving it out of the jurisdiction, the whole game, like an aggressive version of appealing the ruling. And then by late May, because it was a regional board that wasn't as busy as they've all become, right? That was 2016, that big fight. And there weren't nearly as much heat as there is now. So they had a little more time to go do the investigations, right? Now there's elections and stuff going on all over and people taking strikes and ULPs, and the board can't keep up with it, which is why they keep not giving them a penny of an increase of spending. But it really helps to know what to do with those rulings. It immediately lifts up the workers when they get the decision. And it immediately gives them a tool to then take it to the broader community and begin educating everybody about what this fight is going to look like, how hard it's going to be, and why they're going to need to bring their community into the campaign in what I call whole worker organizing method, where the workers themselves chart their connections to the power structure. They don't know what that is when we say it at first, so we have to show them what is an informal power structure. And yes, we might love the completely lefty rabbi or first congregationalist person with the, you know, stuff on vestments on at the rally. But unless those two people scare the mayor of the city and scare the CEOs, it's nice, but actually you're not sending a message of power. And for the workers, the reason why we got a boost right after that ruling to get our first supermajority hand-signed petition saying, we demand you drop the legal charges and get to negotiations, had a little citation in the petition language from the ruling. And we were off and running. And that was the way of beginning to teach the workers, this is actually the way you're going to win. Because even with Abruzzo, there ain't no salvation unless you right. can cost them money and create a crisis. And you have to show it and they have to know it. There's no like, we got a secret majority. I hear that from people all the time. Yeah, don't worry. We got a secret majority. They're just not going to put their name in public. Okay. You don't have anything if a worker won't put their name in public. It's not happening.
Right, because all you're communicating to management is the workers are afraid. That's why they're
terrified.
Not putting their name in public.
Terrified.
So
yeah.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I think it's easy to overstate it, but I wonder if it's also possible to understate the value of Joe Biden walking the picket line. If I understand you correctly, the value there is a signal to the workers that they're on a more righteous side, that to the extent that they can, that it's obvious, you know, like obvious of sort of prima facie, the president's on our side, what we're doing must be right. And then they're emboldened and management sees like, oh, this is going the wrong direction. We wanted the workers to be demoralized by now, not emboldened, and now we're sort of screwed. I mean, that had to have had a big impact.
I think so. I think, again, back to like how beaten down the working class is when it's like, well, the president just gave us validity that our cause is righteous. I mean, that half of these fights are about restoring workers' dignity and respect. It's less about wages. In my lifetime, wages have always been secondary, or at least co-equal with dignity and respect. And depending on the workers that you're organizing, wages could be, because if they're already decent, like my life in hospitals with a lot of registered nurses and stuff, you know, their basic wage is okay. It's that every other aspect of their job, which comes down to respect for their profession, their brains, decisions they get to make, schedules, vacations, the whole nine yards, is often and mostly staffing. Like, what is the staffing? Can I come to work and do a good day's, you know, job?
Right.
So many other issues can motivate people. But having been in so many hard fights so many times, watching and learning better and better as I got older and older, how to use some of these things, like the rulings, getting an important spokesperson on the picket line. I remember in Connecticut years ago, probably late 1990s, leading up to the first ever statewide, would to be statewide Connecticut, every nursing home walkout. And I had responsibility for 8 of the homes that we had just organized. They were newly organized ones. So our team was in direct relationship to the workers. Now we're prepping them for a massive statewide strike. And we got the most powerful ministers. We had assessed 2 of the most powerful ministers. It's not that hard to do. But workers are the only ones who can tell you. You can't go to a database that tells me what's the powerful minister. You can start tracking things like asking workers themselves, hey, election time, it's not legal to endorse, but like, do politicians come to your house of faith, synagogue, mosque, temple, whatever it is, church, around election time, just for a coffee clutch, and your religious leader introduces them to everybody? And if they say yes, that's only a question a worker can answer. If they say yes, I sort political house of faith. If they say never saw a politician in my house of faith ever, they just go to a different pile.
So nice, you're basically
people,
outsourcing
the boss.
You're outsourcing the research essentially to where the power nodes are in to where the politicians have already sort of like figured out who the important clergy are.
Absolutely.
And then you hear from your, I see. It's interesting.
And then they tell you how many, and there's a bunch of them. We do an exercise that's like, if someone called, if your faith leader picked up the phone and called the mayor, and of course, then we're getting moles in City Hall, usually if we're, you know, doing our work right. Would the secretary or whatever assistant, you know, new language, would they interrupt the mayor in an important meeting to say, Minister so-and-so is on the phone and just need you for a quick minute? Would they not interrupt the meeting? Would they get a phone call back the same day when we're out of the meeting? Would they not get a phone call back the same? Like, you can go through the power search analysis that I was trained on, and I've deepened and deepened in every fight because I learned it in the community organizing movement and I took it into the labor movement because I understood community power better, right? Coming into trade union organizing. So molding the two has always been what I've done and teach now. And that is the blending of the two really helps, because we have built a bottom-up method of how the workers themselves are at the center of their own community campaign, not writing checks to people and all that garbage that some big unions do. That didn't work. And at every stage, it gives the workers validation. So now they're getting beat down again. We're in the second round of charges, and we start sending them off. We do the question. We interview each other in break rooms. They tell us which houses of faith they're in. Then we ask them to go to a meeting with their minister and explain what's going on. The faith leader never knows unless there's some hardcore lefty with a teeny place. That's not what we would be doing. We'd be at 7,000 member Black congregations in Philadelphia, right? In 2016, it was even easier because we got a list of every place that Governor Wolf had campaigned. That helped in Philadelphia. Like, there's a lot of ways you can do, but the workers, when you can't get a list from a campaign donor, you know, fundraiser, it's workers. They have the answer to every question. Might take a little bit longer, but they're building the relationship with their faith leader, and they're getting ready to bring them in a powerful faith leader in this case into a powerful fight. And that could double their power if it's done right in a single fight.
So let's turn to, I mean, to the extent that we can assess the UAW's victory. I mean, and I think part of it is there is no doubt. I mean, regardless of what they've been able to get in terms of the contract, obviously that's the whole point. But there is no doubt that the union is sort of like entering into or exiting this process significantly stronger. Like, I mean, that's the thing that really sort of resonates, is that even in the context of like, Fain seems as sort of aggressive about allowing the union membership to reject the contract as he was in getting the contract. Like, he doesn't, there's no, and that seems to empower the union even more, it seems.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's so many things to look for at this stage. And then when we see more of the final agreements and were there side letters and things that are not as obvious. And yeah, there's a lot to see still. But yes, Spain is committed to an incredibly transparent process, and that's fantastic. I think those workers have never known as much about what was going on in negotiations as they did under Fein, really, even when Ruther was there. That was the old big people on a fist, take out a cigar, you know, era, when the whole working class had more power with which to make these threats. Unlike now, when we're practically anemic, you know, by the time I come into the labor movement. So very much more committed to real internal democracy. He campaigned on it. He believes in it. And a central question is, does the struggle make the union stronger? Check that box. Absolutely. Just made the union stronger. Absolutely raised expectations that they're going to win more. So yes, hands down, the success of the strike is clear from the sense of building a stronger union at the end of it and reinstilling the faith of the rank and file members. And what we don't know is how motivating it's going to be to the, you know, non-union sector that's been impossible to organize, the transplants, the German and Japanese auto plants and Korean that are in the U.S. that are just always just beat the wages. They always just beat the wages. Some of what's in this agreement that we do know about, I'll highlight a couple of things, really might make that possible. So first, they won back the COLA and they won back the cost of living adjustment, an annual one. They won back the annual cost of living adjustment from pre-2009, pre the crash of the whole economy. That's very significant. They won back, they condensed and won back to just a three-tier wage scale from like all these tiers that were shoved in and dividing and conquering the workers. They're down to just three tiers. That's quite significant. You couldn't probably go to zero at once. Next contract, maybe they're down to zero tiers with a just progression of years to get to the end of it. But the really big ones, if you're an auto worker in a non-union plant, is they basically eliminated temporary workers. Because just like right. the EPS, where they did not do as well, I don't believe, from what we know about both agreements at this stage, again, all of it's qualified. But what I believe is effective on the ratification, like the 5,000 temporary workers who just never get made permanent in these plants, they're just permatemps. That's like its own, you know, colonized empire, right? Working side by side with people who are full-time and getting a much different daily package. They eliminated temps in the Stellantis agreement, at least, where they're going to get 168% raise if you have been a temp and you become made a full-time worker under the contract. 168% over the life of this agreement. That's bonkers. And more importantly, just hearing that by 9 months out from the ratification, everyone who is a temp will be full-time. That's structural power. And then another one that I think really matters that we know of, that's factual, that you don't have to figure out and wait for the 400-page lawyer thing to come out and read it, is Belvedere, which Fein's been talking a lot about. They literally forcing the company, they got an agreement to reopen a plant they had only recently closed 8 months ago. And as the vice president said in their press release about it, this is a contract that something like shows the way to avoid destroying any more working class communities wholesale in this country. We're gonna rebuild the whole communities that are just being hollowed out when these plants close. Now, it's one victory to reopen a plant, but for people who know anything about negotiations, production decisions, the old concept, like control the production process, some way back idea, that they did it with one huge plant that had just been closed and they destroyed 5,000 lives and destroyed a community. To get that plant to literally open, they had to negotiate a new line would go in there. So it's a new mid-sized truck line that's going to be built at a plant that was just recently mothballed. So it's not too old to take it back into production. They also negotiated getting a battery plant built in Belvedere. That'll be 1,000 more jobs. They got back all 5,000 jobs or whatever the thousands were. I think it's close to that from that community by bargaining smartly and understanding their industry. So that's also pretty amazing. And you know, Fein says all the time, we're going from defense to offense, and that's what they're doing. And that couldn't be enough of that going on in the trade union movement. There's just, you can't have too much of it right now. Like, we need everyone. Climate clock ticking,
right?
Next pandemic's coming, whatever it is, there's deep democracy to save, you know. And we know, I want to make one more point, which I've written about. It's big strikes that lead to changing politics, not politics changing the situation for workers. It's actually quite the opposite. And Chicago and those huge strikes electing Brandon Johnson, their rank and file mayor last spring as mayor. It's United Teachers Los Angeles, where massive strikes have been happening in the education sector, electing Karen Bass, one of the most progressive members in Congress. And then she in turn helped settle that 60,000 worker strike, the more recent one after her election. So it's just the really deep message about how change is going to happen and how we're going to possibly fight to save the planet and everyone on it is by having more massive strikes as fast as we can.
So lastly, what do you see is on the horizon? You know, if we had talked this time last year, we would have said UPS, we would have said maybe UAW. What do you see? What's the next big sector that you see there's going to be a fight?
I mean, the beauty of the two big ones, of the Teamster and the UAW, is that they're national, right? They span labor markets, they span geographic borders, they reach everywhere. And I think, sadly, by the way, I still think it was unfortunate that the Teamsters didn't strike, because as I just said, big strikes actually are what, and workers winning is what, and a sense of their own power is what can then drive politics. But I don't know that there is an immediate something at the scale of the two of these agreements that have just been so exciting. But I do know that there are plenty of places where contracts are being lined up, meaning common expiration dates. The UAW lined up quaintly in the history of sit-down strikes, and now they're stand-up strike with May of 28, for May Day of 2028. And they're starting to message about getting every progressive local, even if they have an unsupportive national union, to like get locals lined up for May 1, 2028. And there's enough time to do that. Like, every time your contract expires, you can set a new expiration date. And I don't mean that's easy. I've had to strike to get an expiration date to line all the hospitals up in Nevada, right? Every bit, going back to Emma's point about strategy, there's so much strategy that goes into winning and winning big. Like, when I started working with some teacher unions, I will not name them, a bunch of years ago, in like California and some other states, I said, first thing I want to see is produce a chart for me of when all these contracts and all your locals expire. And they were like, all over the map. Well, you can't build to a statewide strike if you've got contracts expiring 1 year, the next year, the next year, the next year. You got to line them up. And people, very smart people who hired me to do that work with them, very smart, had never heard of the words contract lineup. Because again, we're so anemic and we're so, right, so forget how to build power. So that's fundamental. So I think it's hard though to just ask for locals to line up for it, because if you're a smart union, like, you have to line up your own sector. That would have been hospitals for me. If the United Auto Workers, it's the auto workers. But if you can't, so you have to line up your industry. And then there's always a puzzle. We were doing this in the good years at SEIU, where we would be trying to figure out, do we line up across a sector or do we make it across a geography? So there's so much strategy to Emma's earlier point that people don't see. Although when I'm running campaigns, I want everyone to see it, certainly all the workers and our top community allies, like, need to understand why we're doing the things we're doing. And the best strikes, they are explaining that, not just to all the workers, but really putting workers at the center of strategy. That's what the new book is, putting workers at the center of negotiation strategy, first contract fight strategy. And if I can get to the next book in time, the entire book is on power and strategy. That's it, what? The whole thing. Like, everything I ever learned about power and strategy, a few things we're saying right now, trying to jam it out fast as I can.
Well, I look forward to reading that. Jane McAlevey, always a pleasure. Can't thank you enough for, you know, all you've taught us, and just like our audience. I know I can just see the IMs, you know, piling up of people who are both inspired by what you're talking about and are going to go out and buy your books and start to organize their workplace. So really appreciate your time today. And we're going to put a link to that great profile that the New Yorker did, as well as your books, of course. But folks will really enjoy that profile as well. Thanks so much for your time today.
Looking forward to coming back. All right.
Yes. All right. Yes. We're looking forward to having you. All right. Thanks, Jane.
Take care.